medium's brain, he would be able to use more of the medium's language. This, indeed, happened, and he spoke in broken English, easily intelligible to us all, but still maintaining a very different personality from that of the medium in his normal state. He instructed the sitter who sat at the extreme end of the left side of the horseshoe to release her left hand and throw it out towards him. She did so, and we could all see a stream of pale gray matter, like fog or steam from a kettle, oozing from her fingers. It was shaped like rods, about a foot long and an inch thick. The medium reached out his hands carefully towards the ends of the rods, and seemed to try and coax the gray 89 material to come farther away from the sitter, towards himself. The rods thinned slightly, as he induced them to extend, and after a couple of minutes the French control said, speaking through the medium again, "No, not strong enough. Link hands up, and close in the power again." The sitters obeyed for a few minutes, during which the electric current became so strong that some of the sitters' hands were jerked up and down. They could not keep them still. The end sitter was instructed to throw out her hand towards the medium, as before, and this time the rod of steamy material was much thicker and longer. There. Control expressed satisfaction, and began the drawing motion again. As he drew their gray substance towards himself, he appeared to rub it vigorously into his chest, and then he threw it in coils round his neck. We could see these coils lying round his neck and shoulders for a few seconds, then they seemed to be absorbed into his body. This operation took several minutes. He then placed the fingers of one hand lightly on the top of the small table, instructing the end sitter to put her left hand on it, too. She did so, and the table rose several feet into the air, lightly and gracefully. It was so high that the sitter had to stand up and hold her arm as high as possible in order to keep her fingers upon it. It was very curious to see, in a bright light, a table in the air without any kind of support under it. A simple phenomenon, but very striking and convincing. The control then told the sitters that he would give them an illustration of what would happen if they were to unloose hands and break the current of power during their seance. He asked one sitter in the center of the horseshoe to unlink, and immediately the table crashed to the ground. The sitters linked up again for a few minutes, and their end sitter was instructed to turn out the gas, which was close to her, after the medium had retired behind the curtains and seated himself on the bentwood chair. We were now almost in darkness except for a faint red light which burned high up in one corner of the room. We had been instructed to sing softly, so as to make the vibrations which appear to be necessary in all circles for materialization or direct voice phenomena. We promised not to let things down by being heavy and silent, and set to work thinking of all the songs we could, so as not to have long pauses in between. I think we all had a feeling that we might have to wait some time before anything happened, and I know my husband had an idea that if he really saw anything under such conditions it would be in a very vague form, probably such a distance away from him that he would not be able to examine it at all closely. Imagine, then, our surprise when the curtains were quickly thrust aside and somebody stepped out, picked up one of the illuminated boards, or slates, and turned the bright side towards himself. By this means we could all clearly see a very tall form of an Indian, about 6 feet 6 inches in height, dressed in a gorgeous robe, with a high turban, and a sword by his side. His robes seemed to be composed of many yards of material, part of it was white and hung in heavy folds from his shoulder. He moved straight across the circle to where my husband sat, and standing straight in front of him, He stooped and put his face close to my husband's, holding the luminous board so that my husband could examine every pore of the skin. I remember that, true to our instructions, we were softly but enthusiastically singing. 90. Annie Laurie. My husband's attempt to keep on singing, with the Indian standing in front of him, was comical. His teeth chattered so loudly that we could hear them above the singing. He told us afterwards that he had never before understood the meaning of his hair stood on end, but now he said he felt his hair rise stiffly on his head. It was unlike anything he had expected. After a minute or so, interest overcame his fright. He looked intently at the Indian's face, and could see, as I afterwards could, the tiny bloodshot veins in his large almond-shaped eyes which he obligingly rolled around, so that my husband could examine them. Then the Indian, whose name we heard later was Abdullah, came over to me, and allowed me to examine him closely, and it was difficult indeed to realize that this handsome and dignified Oriental, whose outfit would have graced a West End production of, let us say, Cheech and Chow, or Kismet, was there in our midst, for the moment apparently as solid as we were ourselves, and yet we knew that he would vanish again in a little while. Even as I watched him, he began to melt. That is the only word I can think of to describe the process by which he gradually disappeared in front of our eyes. It was exactly like holding wax in front of a fire, but there was nothing whatever left afterwards. Several other forms came out from the cabinet, one at a time, sometimes so quickly that one wondered how they had managed to take the power and mold it onto their etheric bodies as to render them temporarily visible to our earthly eyes, because that is what happens at a materializing seance. Of course, in saying this I am trying to describe a complicated operation to you in a few words, when volumes might be, and are, used to do so. In all, about a dozen forms showed themselves, elderly men and women, young men, young women, children, and also a small dog that had belonged to one of the sitters, and who was as pleased to manifest to his mistress, and far more excited about it, judging from his snuffles and pantings and jerky little barks, than even the human spirits were. The latter all expressed their happiness in being able to show themselves in tangible form to their friends on earth, but one knew that they were more anxious about the success of their efforts than was the little dog. The owner of the dog sat next to my husband, and when the dog ran to her he placed his two front paws on her knee, and his two hind feet were resting on my husband's foot, who said afterwards that their dog weighed just about the same as a dog of that breed, it was a Pekingese, would weigh in its physical body. We happened to have a Pekingese at the time that often stood on one's feet in order to clamber up to one's knee. A few minutes afterwards another spirit materialized for another sitter some distance away on my left. As we were sitting in a half circle I could only see the profile of the spirit, but I recognized him as the husband of the lady from a photograph I had seen of him. I noticed that he wore rather old-fashioned clothes, a black coat and a very broad white starched front with turned down collar and black tie. A woman sitting next to me on my right hand nudged me, and whispered, "Look, it isn't 91. A spirit at all, it's the medium dressed up. I recognize his coat at the back, and his collar. 2. The beard, shirt front, and black coat are only hung on in front of him." She persisted in this, and it upset and worried me. I sent out a silent prayer that some light should be thrown on the matter, as I myself thought the back of the coat looked different from the front. An answer came quickly and unexpectedly. The materialized spirit vanished, and in his place came Abdullah again. He stood right in front of me, looking at me in a searching manner. I felt there was something he wanted to tell me or show me, so my eyes never left him. As he walked slowly across the room to the opposite corner where the medium lay back in a chair, in deep trance, holding up the illuminated slates, the spirit showed us the medium and himself side by side. How glad and relieved I was. Unfortunately, the sitting came to an end soon after. I think that the difficult mental atmosphere that had arisen through my and the other sitter's doubts was responsible for breaking up the séance sooner than was usual, as I found out during the long series of sittings that I had later, though so much had happened in it that was a revelation to many of us. The medium was terribly exhausted afterwards, and that is always the case when an adverse condition has sprung up during the sitting. When the conditions were perfect clear dry weather, which is so important to physical manifestations, and experienced and sympathetic sitters were present, the medium seemed to experience little or no fatigue. I once sat with the same medium, with only three friends present, making five of us in the circle, and a thunderstorm came on while we were sitting. The thunderstorm outside was nothing to the thunderstorm in the room, I can assure you. It was terrifying. The room and sitters were illuminated by great blinding sheets of light, and the electric shocks were so severe that I felt that if they became any stronger, we should be electrocuted. The medium's chief guide suddenly spoke during a temporary pause in the fireworks, and said in an urgent and rather angry manner, "Unloose hands, and stop the sitting at once. Can't you see that you are forming a battery? It is most dangerous, stop at once." We did so. The condition of the medium was pitiable. He could scarcely stumble out of the room. It had evidently been a great strain on him. 92. Chapter 27, A Spirit Wakes Us Up a Bit. We had many sittings with this medium, and my husband became more and more interested. One evening a control called Joey, who in his earth life was a famous clown, said to my husband, whom he had often teased for being so reserved and quiet, "Freddy, are you always so quiet? If so, I think I shall have to come and visit you in your home, and see if I can't wake you up a bit." My husband said, "Well, Joey, I should like it very much if you would, but how should I know you were there, as we have no power of this kind to enable you to manifest?" "Oh, yes, you have," said Joey. "I think you've got just enough for me to use, so that I can let you know when I'm there, one way or another." I know my husband was very dubious as to Joey being able to do anything of that kind at home. We lived in London, in a maisonette, which was composed of the ground floor and the semi-basement. Our own sitting room and dining room were in this semi-basement, and there was quite a long flight of stairs up to the entrance door of the flat. When one opened this door, it led into the hall, about 15 or 16 feet long, at the farther end of which was the door used by the occupants of the flats above ours. This door was kept closed, but could always be opened from inside or out, while an electric push bell was fixed on the private doors leading to each flat. The bell on our door rang in their basement. After Joey's promise to wake my husband up, this bell rang several times every day of the week following. Just as my husband sat down to a meal, the bell would ring, loudly and long. My husband would jump up and go up the stairs as quickly as possible, only to find no one there. He got very tired of this after a day or two, and rather angry, thinking some mischievous boys were doing it. He kept watch but could see no one loitering about. One afternoon I had been shopping, and I came in by the general entrance door, closed it after me, walked down the hall to the door of the flat, and rang the bell. Just as my husband was opening the door for me, I happened to glance at there. Bell and, to my amazement, I saw the little knob sink in, just as though an invisible finger had pressed it. Simultaneously we heard the ring of it from downstairs. My husband and I looked at each other in amazement. We could not understand it. The next evening we went to our materializing seance, and the first words that Joey spoke were to my husband. "Freddy," he said, "I did wake you up, didn't I?"
"What do you mean, Joey?"
my husband asked. "The bells, of course," Joey replied. 93. My husband told him that he was now sufficiently impressed that Joey had the power to wake him up, and that he need not trouble to do it anymore, but Joey said he thought he could do a few more little things which would interest us, and then he would stop. We thanked him for all the trouble he was taking. I was secretly rather pleased that my husband was getting a really good dose of evidence that supernormal things could be done in one's own home. Joey now tried a new line. As soon as my husband placed any of his belongings, tobacco pouch, matchbox or pipe, anywhere, they disappeared. He would put something on the corner of the mantelpiece, look away for a second, look back, and it was gone. 3 days or so later it would be replaced in exactly the same spot, often only a moment after one had looked at the place, and seen that nothing was there. The most remarkable of these little experiments was carried out one evening when we were setting out to dine at a friend's house, 12 miles away. She was sending her own car for us at 6 o'clock. Just as we had settled ourselves in the car, my husband jumped up, saying, "Great Scott, I've left my lighted pipe in the middle of your bed. Gladys, I put it there for a second while I got my coat out of the wardrobe, and then forgot it. It may have set fire to the eiderdown." He dashed into the house, and after a few minutes he came out again looking worried. "It isn't there," he said, "and it isn't anywhere in the house, as far as I can see." I told him to shake his coat and turn out all his pockets, which he did to no purpose. His pipe was a fairly large-sized one, not easily hidden in a pocket. We went to our friends, dined there, danced for an hour or so after, and then I went upstairs, put on my coat and came down into the drawing room again to say goodbye to our hostess. Just as I advanced towards her, I felt something touch my sleeve. No one was within several feet of me. I looked at my arm, and there, sticking in my cuff, was the lost pipe. I stared at it, so did everybody else. The cuff of my coat was so narrow that only a small portion of the mouthpiece could fit into it. Next time we spoke to Joey, we assured him that we had had ample evidence of his ability to squeeze enough power out of us to show us that he was there, and that he need not exert himself further in those directions. As a rule, the order of phenomena in these seances was very much the same. There, medium went into trance, was controlled, then into a deeper trance, and the guides who worked with him would speak and show themselves, then they would assist the relatives and friends of the sitters to come through and manifest. Of course, the regular operators were more proficient in every way than the newcomers, who often could only just build up their faces for us to see, whereas the more experienced were able to show us their entire forms, and every detail of their clothing. How absurd it would be to imagine that in such a seance as I have described to you, their medium could be dressing himself up in all these elaborate costumes, with sometimes only a few seconds in between the changes, and sometimes no interval at all. We have often seen one materialized spirit lay the illuminated slate on the floor, and there. 94. Second one pick it up with lightning-like rapidity. You might almost say that the one snatched it from the other, so eager were they to be seen while the power lasted. With some of the materializations it only lasts a few seconds, with others 10 to 15 minutes. Then, think of the wonderful makeup the medium would require. People talk about masks, lifelike affairs that delude people into thinking that they are materialized human faces. My husband is familiar with all kinds of makeup, skins, false foreheads, scalps, and facial additions, but he says that one can detect them most easily at a distance of a few inches, under a good light. The medium would require a huge wardrobe of every kind of men's, women's, children's clothing, Eastern dress, English dress of all periods, military uniforms, etc. Where could he put them in the space at his disposal behind there? Curtains, about 3 feet wide, with only just room for his chair in the extreme corner? Of course, I am speaking now of remarkably successful sittings, due to good conditions in the way of weather, health of the medium and the sitters, which is important, but I have attended sittings when the chief control has said, almost at the commencement, "We shan't get anything tonight, conditions not right. We'd better disperse as it's no good wasting the medium's power by waiting." Occasion ally, owing to the importunity of some of the sitters, who might have come a long distance and were disappointed at having to go away again without seeing any manifestation, the guides would kind-heartedly endeavor to use the small amount of power at their disposal, but the results were very poor, the materialization consisting of indistinct, blurred features that might have belonged to anybody. As the spirit of one young man, who was killed in the war, said to his mother at a later sitting, referring to his attempts to show her his face, "Mum, I felt as if I looked more like a badly boiled suet pudding than anything else." If a skeptic had been present at one of these unsatisfactory sittings, he might have been forgiven for thinking that the whole thing was either a clumsy fraud, or worthless for the purpose of proving human survival. 95. Chapter 28, Concerning Fairies and Their Aids. During the war, the chief control would always know if there was an impending air raid. How he knew I don't know, but I surmise that these controls were probably working around the medium, and perhaps the seance room, sometime before the sitting. Indeed, they have often told us that there is a great deal to be done in the way of adjusting the psychic conditions around a medium previously to a sitting. I have often been aware that something of this kind was being done to me, and one has carefully to guard against ill temper, anxiety or excitement of any kind while this tuning in process is taking place. I often think that mediumship means constant practice in self-control. Imagine, then, what a great deal there may be for the guides to do in preparing the little understood, complicated background of the physical seance. As the guides appear to be actually functioning in the earth conditions for the time being, they probably retain a great deal of the sensitiveness that they possess on their own spirit plane, and are thus able to sense approaching danger, as horses and cattle sense fire that they cannot see and which may be some distance away. At any rate, on 3 or 4 separate occasions, the chief guide warned us that we must not delay, but must go home as quickly as possible, because the enemy airplanes or zeppelins would soon be over London. They were never wrong in their predictions, and one night their warning was specially addressed to me, so as my husband had not accompanied me on this occasion, and knowing that he would be anxious about me should an official air raid warning be given, I hurried home, arriving the more quickly than usual, because everything, tubes and buses, seemed to fit in remarkably well. No signal had been given when I entered our home, and, as I knew the guides had always been correct, I thought I would begin my usual bread making for the week to fill in the time. It was never any use going to bed to be awakened by the terrific noise of the anti-aircraft guns. Then, too, the people from the flats above ours used to come down and ask if they could sit in our basement, so we had to get up to let them in. Hardly had I mixed the dough, and set it to rise in the kitchen, when the air raid started. It was the worst one we had experienced. Shrapnel simply hailed on the roof, and as our kitchen was built out at the back of the house, and was partly glass-roofed, I had to dodge backwards and forwards to attend to the bread as best I could. Suddenly a bomb was dropped close to us, our windows were broken, electric lights went out, pictures were blown across the room, and afterwards we found that five large houses composed of flats were all demolished, and 15 poor people, including two personal friends of ours, were buried beneath the ruins. As soon as I had pulled myself together, the noises deafened me for a couple of minutes. I rescued the dough and put it into a place of greater safety, and went up and opened the front door to see what had happened. The street was literally covered with 96 broken glass, bricks and pieces of coping stone, some of it blown from a couple of hundred yards away. I then realized why the guide had specially warned me, as I was the only city living in this neighborhood, and had I stayed in the medium's house till the usual time, I should have been passing through the affected area just about the time that this huge bomb fell, and I don't see how I could possibly have avoided being injured by the flying pieces of masonry, etc. Occasionally we had materialization of a different kind altogether, little spontaneous happenings that were very interesting indeed. For instance, the whole circle were concentrating on watching a form endeavoring to show himself by the light of their illuminated slate, which was not very strong that night as the medium had neglected to recover it with phosphorescent paint, for which he got a good scolding from his guides. During the sitting, my husband was sitting with his feet and knees rather wide apart. His gaze was suddenly diverted from the materialized spirit to a kind of glow near his feet. Looking down, he saw a tiny man and woman, between 12 and 18 inches high, standing between his knees. They were holding hands and looking up into my husband's face, as if they were thinking, "What on earth is that?" They seemed to be as interested, if not more so, in him, and the details of his appearance, as he was in theirs. He was too astonished to call anybody else's attention to the tiny people, who were dressed in bright green, like the pictures of elves and fairies, and who wore little pointed caps. A slight glow surrounded them, or emanated from them, he wasn't sure which, but it was strong enough for him to see their little faces and forms clearly. After a moment or two, they disappeared, apparently melting into the floor. Another time I found myself sitting next to a stranger in the circle. At least, he was a stranger to me, but he had attended the circles two or three times when I had not been present. I did not hear his name, nor he mine, but I gathered from his remarks that he was a naval man, and I should think an extremely practical, straightforward, no nonsense about him type of man. During the sitting, which was a good and prolific one, while a great deal was happening that was occupying the attention of the whole circle, who always looked in one direction most of the time, that is towards the curtained corner, as the materialized spirits usually came from there, I suddenly felt a chill come over me, and at the same moment I felt my neighbor, the naval man, give a slight shiver. You will remember that we always held hands during the seance. In a few seconds I felt as cold as ice. So, apparently, did the naval man, judging by his hand. He turned to me and whispered, "Do you feel anything?"
terribly cold at our backs, isn't it? I agreed, the cold seemed to come from behind us. I looked over my right shoulder.